the question, if you can't save all, whom should you save? It's also a drama. So there are many opinions. There are many opinions about it. One opinion is you simply draw lots. You leave it to chance. You leave it to chance. You have no right to decide. Because this decision cannot be entrusted to me, because I always prefer the man who is charismatically, so to say, prominent, who delivered a good charisma, who deserved, the recognition of the crowd. Another opinion is that if you can't save all, so you let all be killed. It's an extreme opinion. Don't be saved by the death of others. I'll give you the example. Two people, the famous Talmudic statement, two people walk in the desert. They have only one pitcher of water. One can be saved, the other one cannot be saved. The pitcher of water is interesting. So the law is so, if the pitcher of water is in the possession of one, he may drink the water. But however, if the pitcher of water is not in the possession of one, but in some place, so both must die. And of course, if one is stronger, he could run into that place and get hold of the pitcher of water before the weaker one will get there. Both must die, and no one must be saved by the death of his friend. We are very strict about it. You ask a good question. Did we implement these laws? In the Middle Ages, yes, these laws. In the medieval Jew was perhaps ignorant, but there was an ethical personality. He implemented them. However, in modern times, of course, I can tell you. But it's indicative of our approach to the individual. Let me give you another example. Perhaps this example is a little more characteristic, because it does not deal with emergencies, with situations which are these tragic situations. But it's a general law pertaining to an everyday situation. By contact with dead bodies, you know that. You can find it in the Bible if you want to. Just for reference, I want to say. This is Leviticus 21. We all know that the priests, the Kohanim, who were enjoined from defiling themselves by contact with dead bodies, you know that. You can find it in the Bible if you want to. Just for reference, I want to say. This is Leviticus 21, verse 1. From 1 to 15. There shall none defile himself for the dead among his people. You know, it was very strict, very strictly enforced. And the Kohen who was defiled could not enter the sanctuary or the temple. He could not worship. Could not be part of the service. It means simply he was, for a period of 7 days at least, he was excommunicated for defiling himself with the dead body. The philosophy of it is a different story. There is a certain aversion on the part of Judaism to our death. Judaism felt helpless in the face of death. It's a different story. Yes. The law is as such that the ordinary priest, the Kohen, must not defile himself with dead bodies other than immediate relatives. And immediate relatives are seven relatives. Wife, children, brother and sister, and parents. However, it was forbidden to the high priest to come in contact and contaminate himself with any dead, even if they are his closest relatives. As it is said in the chapter I referred you to, because the father has other. There are other people who attend to the funeral, who make the proper arrangements. You want to express your emotions, your love for your father, you are forbidden to do so. But if the high priest was traveling on the highway and found a dead body, just a corpse, state of disintegration, so he must take care of the body and bury it. He must not defile himself with the beloved father and mother, because there are others who will make the appropriate arrangements. Yet if he comes across a dead body that has been dumped somewhere, murdered in the field or in the woods, he is duty bound to defile himself, to preoccupy himself with its internment. Now this is the law.
Now, let me just a bit dramatize it a bit this law. But this is true, I mean. As a matter of fact, the Talmud spoke of such an incident. We may imagine the following complication. The following complication which may arise on such an occasion. The date is Erev Yom Kippur, so the day preceding Yom Kippur. The high priest has readied himself for the great day of atonement for months and weeks. Because on that day of atonement, he will represent the Jewish people before the Almighty in the inner sanctum. Normally sanctum, sanctorum meant, God, Chikadashim, no one had, was allowed to enter, only the high priest. For the great ceremonial of the service of the Day of Atonement, this service could only be performed by the high priest. No ordinary priest had access to the temple on that day. There's only one priest who could appear as a spokesman representing the Jewish community on that great, holy, sacred day for the high priest. Whoever has even a fleeting knowledge of the history of the Second Commonwealth knows what the service on the Day of Atonement meant to the people. Sacrifices, confessions, kneeling. The high priest on that day was, so to say, the beloved hero of the Jewish community. We have Roman sources, not only Jewish sources, Roman historians, recorded the ceremonial how the high priest was escorted from his house into the temple and taken back at night and evening, back to his home. I mean, he was the most admired person. I mean, an echo of this you can still find in this service on the Day of Atonement read in the synagogues and temples. The famous, so to say, hymn, how great was the high priest when he left the sanctuary. Manedoraya Kengo. The man was the man whom millions admired and for whose safety they ardently prayed. And I'm not exaggerating that. I'm not dramatizing that. The passage in Ben Sira, we have from the famous poet of the Second Commonwealth, Ben Sira, the Apocryphal, which we still recite on the Day of Atonement, reveals to us, abounds in superlatives describing, portraying the high priest on the Day of Atonement. We still hear the ecstatic voices of the crowd, which watch the high priest performing the magnificent service. And yet, this is just an introduction, and yet, the high priest, this day, Erev Yom Kippur, just a few hours before sunset, the high priest is about to perform the most glorious service of the year, which is eagerly anticipated by the entire community, took a walk in the woods and found the body. And there is a question in the Talmud whether what should come first. Shall he just walk back to town, nothing else? Just back to town. It's not far from town, a few miles from town. Go back or ride back to town on a donkey and a horse and tell the people there's a dead body, take care of it, and he shouldn't touch the body because he must be fit for the service, for the performance in the temple. Or he should disregard everything else. Disregard. Forget the whole world, the community, and what he has to do tomorrow. And bend down, pick up the dead body on his shoulder and bring it to the town, of course. And of course, and this was a question, and the question was answered unequivocally, yes. He must not leave the body even for 1 second. He must forget his duties. All his commitments to the community. His ceremonial, his pride in being able to perform this great ceremony and entering the sanctuary, the sanctum sanctorum, and attend to the beauty, to become a grave digger person. And yet the high priest is about to perform the most glorious service of the year, which eagerly anticipates that the entire community must take care of the burial and thus defile and disqualify himself from worshipping God on the most solemn day of the year. The absence of the high priest and the people always, I mean, were a bit superstitious. If something happened to the high priest, it was a bad omen, a bad sign. And the people, the absence of the high priest may cancel out the whole service because there was no one else to substitute for him. No one else was trained. It was a very complex service. And they used to train the high priest for weeks how to perform it. It may cancel out the whole service. on that day, since in some cases there might be no one to replace him. Still, the high priest must dismiss from his mind the great ceremonial, the community, the temple, glory and joy associated with the service, and devote himself to a dreary task of grave digging and carrying a dead body, which in a state of disintegration and decomposition. Why? Why should he disappoint the entire community and forfeit the noblest of experiences, the one of catharsis and purification on the Day of Atonement? Who was this person whose body was abandoned? Let us understand. Who was this person whose body was abandoned? The king? And the king's body is taken care of. The archbishop comes to his funeral. Well, certainly not an important figure. Some, of course, whose body could be abandoned and no one demanded the body, asked for the body. Some anonymous being, perhaps a vagabond or a leper. A leper usually lived in the woods. I mean, were not admitted to the community. A leper or a sinner was expelled, excommunicated from his hometown. Why should the great aristocrat, and the high priest was considered as the aristocrat of the community, who is charged with responsibility for the spiritual welfare of the Jewish community, defile himself and thus not realize the hopes and expectations of millions of people? What is the answer? For the sake of burying a vagabond, some anonymous person. The answer to it is a simple one. The greatness of the individual is the supreme principle in Judaism. It reigns supreme. The inner worth of the person, which is dependent not upon accomplishment and success, but upon his uniqueness and loneliness, is the foundation of Judaic ethics. Each person, however humble his station is in life, and however downtrodden and anonymous he is, however inferior he is in every respect to his fellow man, however poor in attainments, each person is blessed with something singular, and ipso facto he is great. And the whole service, the idea of forgiveness and mercy and catharsis on the Day of Atonement, the message of the day, the sanctity of the temple, would be stripped of their meaning and become a mockery if the person who is selected to represent the Jewish community before the Almighty did not appreciate the glory of the individual and the worth and dignity of the helpless, forlorn, wretched person, the vagabond, the pauper, the prostitute, who might have lost everything in life, but not the image of God. This is a law. It's very characteristic of our approach. Why?
The concept of the community or the concept of the individual
is
something that Julius didn't completely accept either. There was a kind of...
Yes, I always said, yes, I said so. As far as individual is concerned, he must place the community above his interests. As far as others are concerned, they must place the Tao above the community. You see, this is the dialectical swinging. I must do everything in order to promote the welfare of the community. And even if supreme sacrifice is required, we'll come to certain laws of life. On the contrary, when you treat me, then I am above the community. You have no right to say that millions of people expect atonement should come first and the poor individual should be buried later. You must place the individual above the community. This is how Judaism operates.
As yes, sir. Talking about man's responsibility and relation to man, therefore this also includes, although it has, I imagine, it extends itself to every man, irrespective of color, creed, religion, etc.
Certainly. I want you to understand, when we speak, we operate with two concepts in Judaism. The question is our parochial approach and our universal approach. You know, many followers of Jewish people accuse Judaism of being too parochially minded. I mean, what all the laws they promulgate and formulate, good laws, but they say the laws apply only to their own kind, it means, to the Jew, but not to the Gentile, you know what I mean. Basically, I want to be very truthful in you. I don't want to engage in apologetics, We operate with two concepts. We speak of the dignity of the personality we also speak of the sanctity of the personhood. Until now, I've been speaking not about sanctity of the personality. I've never mentioned this word, yeah? Never mentioned. But the dignity of the personality. Many laws come under the category of dignity of the personality. Other laws come under the category of sanctity of the personality. If you ask me whether we are parochial or universal in our approach, I'll give you the straight answer. And this is the true answer. If dignity of the personality is involved, there is no distinction as to race, color, religion between the Bushman in Australia and the great Jewish scholar in New York or in Jerusalem. If it's a question of the sanctity of the personality, we speak of a charismatic community, a chosen community. And of course, the chosen community, we are committed to the Jewish community. But social ethics does not deal with the sanctity of the personality, but with the dignity of the personality. So all ethical laws, all civil laws are equally applied to all men. Yes, sir.
This law that you just elaborated on, doesn't that somehow contravene the basic thing that you're trying to tell us?
Why?
Now let me say what I have in mind. You made the analogy of the parrot's melody without words, without physical attributes. You are putting, the law puts the sanctity of the body, of the physical body.
Not sanctity. I'll just object to the term sanctity.
The importance.
No, the body is important because the body, basically, if you are made right, Judaism again differed from Christianity in one respect. When Christianity spoke of man, it had a mind, a soul, a spiritual man, whatever. Judaism always, in this regard, Judaism is very close to the scientific interpretation. Judaism looked upon man, first of all, as a body. And that's why the body, the dignity of the personality, is reflected on the body as well.
Even to the exclusion of what the appearance of the high priest at the service would do, by the inner self of the whole community.
Yes, sir. You see, again, we are so much influenced by Christian concept, the spiritual meaning of that heart. We have never operated with such concept. Yes, sir. Yes.
It seems that there's a kind of a spiritual commitment of man to man, even before man to God in this situation, or man to the God in man. If the high priest's duty...
I understand. I understand your question. Let me answer this. I intended to talk about it, but I'll talk later about it in just a short. You see, if one should ask me, Once a Christian theologian asked me, what do I consider the greatest achievement of Judaism? What is the most singular contribution that Judaism made toward, the welfare, the spiritual welfare of mankind? Of course, you tell monotheism, yes, but this is already an old phrase. As we say in Yiddish, Sata Bot has a long beard. And monotheism, if you read about monotheism, of course, Jewish religion is monotheistic, but you may find monotheistic philosophies among the Greeks as well, not being aware of Jewish monotheism, and perhaps even in Egyptian cultural orbit, there were attempts to introduce a monotheistic religion, monotheistic cult. This is not a great, huh? Yeah, all right. But what is important, the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest contribution of Judaism, that Judaism made to art, the spiritual welfare of mankind, is that Judaism unified and combined cult with the ethos. If you will take a great man like Socrates or Plato, so he said, the gods, how do you serve the gods? Or God, it doesn't matter whether gods or God. How do you serve them? How do you serve them? You have to, so to say, to discharge your specific duties toward them. Sacrifices, prayer, service, build temples, erect statues, honor, sing hymns to them. But the gods of the Olympus, they are not interested in my relationship to my fellow man. This is my own business. This is my own problem. Philosophy will deal with this. So, of course, pagan religion had no ethic. All the gods were interested in was in cult, in cultic performances. As a matter of fact,
The gods themselves were a very lax morals. I mean, you know, the you couldn't trust them much. They were deceitful, they were lusty, full of lust and gluttony, I mean, sneaky. I mean, that's clear of you, as you know, the Greek mythology. And this is true of every pagan culture. I'm pointing out, I mean, the Greek, because the Greek is cultural, you know, something of civilization, and it made a tremendous contribution to the advancement of society. Judaism was the first religion which came. You serve God. Of course, there are certain forms of service to God, cultic service. But this is not the main service. God is interested in your ethical life, in morality. You can serve me not only by sacrificing. Sacrificing is an unimportant detail in Judaism. Of course, as I always said, an institutionalized religion must have some tangible forms of worship, otherwise it cannot exist. It will disappear in thin air. But I'm interested how you treat your fellow man, how you treat the laborer, how you treat the poor, how you treat the pauper. Up your hand and support the man who is about to fall. I mean, support him. I mean, how you treat your father and mother. How the king, how he treats his citizens. I mean, the ethos, you serve God not only by sacrifice, but also and perhaps mainly by realizing the moral law which was introduced by God. This is very important. You'll take the Decalogue. I mean, if you count all the injunctions, I would say the precepts in the Decalogue, how many are occupied with this cult, with the cultic performance, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, how many? Not even one. Even the Sabbath has a social meaning to us. In order that your slave and your ox and the beast in the field should rest. And you should remember that you were a slave in Egypt. And that's why I want you to handle your slaves in a decent manner. And this was the first foundation of Judaism. Of course, we have an institution of sacrifice too, but it's secondary importance. And what did all the prophets preach? I mean, people say the prophets were opposed to sacrifice, to worship, to cult. It isn't true. This is again a mistake on the part of the Bible preachers. They were not opposed to cult. And men must engage in cultic performances. You see, you cannot take religion and equate it completely with the ethos. You'll feel that you miss something. There is in man something which demands, I would say, expression and manifestations in cultic forms, through a service. There is a service, we have a service, a temple service, we have prayers, but they are secondary. That's why I say, when liberal Judaism says the temple is the center of Jewish life, and conservative Jews say, I mean, the synagogue is the center, and now Orthodox rabbis begin to say that the Knesset is in the center, I say they are all lying. Neither the Reformed Temple, nor the Conservative Synagogue, nor the Orthodox Beta Knesset. The center of Jewish life is the home, the street, the shop, I mean, the nightclub, the beach, I mean, the highway. I mean, God is everywhere. Of course, it's very nice to come into a temple. If the temple reflects my life outside of the temple. But if there is the great gap, you understand, this gulf separating my mundane life, my behavior in my office, my relationship to my employees, I mean, then my humble attitude in the temple, if there's the gulf, that's what the prophets say. What's the use you bring the sacrifice if your hands are stained with blood? No contradiction. Judaism always required unity. And unity means consistency, identity, the same person. You see, what is the trouble with Catholicism? The problem with Catholicism is psychologically that the Catholic basically is a schizophrenic. There's a split in his personality. I can imagine, we'll take an example, take Franco in Spain. Of course, his hands are stained with blood. So I can imagine very well, and I believe I've never seen him, so I can imagine that Franco comes here on Easter Sunday. Easter Sunday, every Sunday attends Mass, he's a pious, devout Catholic, he comes into the cathedral in Madrid, kneels, bends his head against the stones of the cathedral, against the stone floor of the cathedral, and says the famous Latin dictum, non mea voluntas, set tua fiat, not my will, but yours should become real. And he means it, he certainly means it, it's not hypocrisy. I don't say it's hypocrisy. He is humble,
humble and he submits himself to divine will, to divine judgment, and prays for atonement, and he delivers himself into God's hands. Oh, I should say he's a high hypocrite. I mean, the word hypocrisy we used to laugh at. But this is, peace prevails as long as he's enveloped by the shadows of the Kasidah. As long as he's intoxicated by the fragrance of the incense which is burned on the altar. As long as the Savior, I mean, looks upon him from the crucifix. But the moment he steps over the threshold, you see, of the cathedral, into clear sunlight, so he can sign on the threshold of the cathedral a death sentence, I mean, for a young revolutionary, if it's possible. Such a thing to Judaism, this is the most abominable, the most incomprehensible, the most paradoxical experience. That's your question. You ask me, there is a duty, yeah, there is a duty to God. But the duty to bury the dead is also a duty to God. And the question how you serve God, through bringing sacrifices or through burying a lonely person, the second duty takes precedence over the first one. All right, let's stop for a while. Of course, it's a continuation of the lecture you delivered me 3 weeks ago, I believe, yes?
Yes.
You'll excuse me that I couldn't be here last Thursday, I had to be in Washington. And this is a continuation of the lecture. If you will just try to pick up the thread, and that we discussed the problem of the, what do you call, luminous men for himself, men without accomplishments for society, men who haven't contributed anything to the further advancement of mankind. But the worth of man is in himself. Well, that's what we discussed, and how Judaism in many forms, I mean, in halakhic level, has emphasized time and again the worth of the person without accomplishment. And I said that Judaism reached paradoxically, and we would say has formulated a paradoxical ideal. It means the apotheosis of anonymity. The anonymous person. And if one is anonymous, apparently he didn't distinguish himself, but because he's anonymous, so there is inner worth to him. This is the Judaic approach, perhaps an impractical approach. And that time I give you the example how the community must not sacrifice individual, even if the individual, I mean, is ethically, morally, I mean, actually a corrupt and say, personality. And also about the case, the queer case of the high priest finding an abandoned corpse on the day preceding Yom Kippur, how he must defile himself and bury the corpse, although by so doing he'll disqualify himself from officiating at the service. It means the most solemn service of the year is being overridden by the need on the part of King God to understand the tragedy and also the worth of the abandoned, lonely person. Now I'll continue with a few more examples, because I'm very typical, it's very tender attitude, but it's very typical of Judaism. Interesting also is the maxim in the Talmud. Agre de kala duchto. Kala used to be the famous assemblies in Talmudic times, to which scholars from all parts of, say, of Babylonia and Palestine used to get together to assemble, and it was academic, actually, I mean, academic conferences, and all kinds of topics were discussed and analyzed. I mean, people delivered lectures and so forth on. And basically, Talmud, the Talmudic literature, is a result of such assemblies, of those assemblies. So the Talmud says that the participants in the Kala assembly, they're called Kala, the participants in the Kala assemblies. Probably it's due to the fact that there were universal assemblies, like the Catholics call now ecumenical, I mean, universal assemblies. I mean, they discussed a variety of subjects in those assemblies. I mean. And actually, those assemblies were the most, you may say they were legislative in character. I mean, they used to lay down the law, formulate, interpret the law. And actually, I mean, Judaism, halakhic Judaism, is a result of those assemblies. So the participants in the Kala assemblies will be rewarded in accordance, rewarded by God. And let's not forget that Talmud Torah, I mean, the study of the law, study of the Torah, is considered by Judaism one of the most, most significant deeds on the part of man. So it will be rewarded not in accordance with their intellectual achievements, but with the amount of discomfort they underwent during the sessions. So for instance, two people, for instance, it's very strange, two people participated in a Torah symposium. One was bright and scholastically well-trained, and hence enjoyed the discussion, the brilliance of the debaters, and the ingenuity of the intellectual combat at the symposium. The other one, with a very limited capacity, bordering almost on the dull, did not grasp the fine points of discussion. He could not follow the reasoning of the opponents. He was bored and lonely. He felt that he did not belong to that circle of great intellect. I mean, if I should come into a society of theoretical physicists, let me help you like that. So, that he was an outsider who could never be integrated into the world of thought. And yet, he diligently attended all sessions, listened carefully to each word out of them. He could not tear himself away from the academy. Why, I mean, men act sometimes irrationally. If he didn't understand, so why didn't he leave? So I ask also, why do you sit here and listen to me? Because I don't say anything new. Basically what I say is commonplace in Judaism. It's a truism. And I believe you know as much as I do about it. Perhaps I formulate it a little different. But people are irrational. Many times I attend, and many times I can understand why people come to listen to my speeches and lectures. So there's nothing new in me. I mean, I'm not a sense of false modesty. I mean, what I say is something which everybody feels. I try to spell it out. But somehow people act in irrational manner sometimes. He could not tear himself away from the academy. He was very uncomfortable, depressed and angered by the fact, of course, in that case, that he somehow was outside of the debate, outside of that circle. And he wasted his time. The psychological reason why he did it is irrelevant and simply, I mean, immaterial. The fact that he felt uncomfortable because of certain either drawbacks or because the people bored him, he knew more than they. God will measure the reward not by the standards of accomplishment, but by those of pain and suffering, the individual experiences. It means agre de kale durke, means reward for a scholastic session, depends how hard the bench was, the bench on which the person was sitting. Durke means pressure. Yehadus insisted upon full axiological democracy. You see, this is a kind of democracy which modern man doesn't understand. Modern man understands political democracy, as I said once, understands also perhaps economic democracy, as the, so to say, socialist countries claim to understand. It isn't true, perhaps, but he doesn't understand democracy axiological as to the worth of the press. That the great scholar, the scientist, and the little person have the same worth, that's Madhur Man didn't understand, and I don't believe I understand, and perhaps no one understands. But Judaism insisted upon it. Judaism was both realistic at times, and at times it was daydreaming, simply. Completely caught in the web of fantasy and imagination. But it was a beautiful fantasy, at least. I mean, fortunately, I'll tell you frankly, for instance, now with the emergence of the State of Israel, I utter one prayer, and simply my mind many times is disturbed. We have a beautiful attic. And to say that we were angels, hard to say, but more or less, the pages of our history are not stained with blood and tears and injustice and brutality as the pages of history, I mean, of the European society. Let us take the feudal times, the medieval times. Simple reason, not because perhaps we are superior to them, we simply did not encounter the challenge. We never had a state, we never had political problems. Each one lived for himself. A private person cannot commit. A private person, a weak person, a persecuted person, a person who did not have anything to say, could not commit the injustices of which, for instance, France or Germany or feudal England committed, I mean, in the Middle Ages, of course. What if our history had been different, had taken a different course? What if we had been a state, I mean, in the Middle Ages? How would we have had? Just like the feudal lords, or we would have acted differently because of Judaic ethics. I have no answer to that. Who knows? I mean, to say hypothetically why, how we would have acted is ridiculous. Now with the state of Israel, I mean, the test is come. We are facing the test. Will we behave like any other state ethically? And basically, any state is not ethical. I don't believe that a state that in itself implies an intrinsic contradiction to ethics. The best one. Will we act differently? Will we, restrain ourselves from engaging in certain practices which are in conflict with the basic Judaic ethics, or will yield temptation? Of course, a few experiences are not very assuring, I must tell you. Others somehow hold out, a hope. I don't know. What is it to me? This is the basic problem with which we diaspora Jews are faced with regard to the state of Israel. Never mind helping. Helping is a different story. I'll come to the problem yet. But the problem is, here we have an opportunity. The Jews are the rulers. They legislate the laws. They are, so to say, the masters. We have never been masters in our history. We've always been the subordinates, always. Since the destruction of the Second Temple, it's 1900 years ago, I mean, it's quite a time. It's a long time. Now we are the masters, of course, in a small land, in a narrow strip along the Eastern Mediterranean. Will we act like masters, or will we understand it that Judaism does not know the concept of master and slave, victor and vanquished, powerful and weak? I mean, this is my problem with regard to the state of Israel. I mean, the whole Jewish history will be interpreted in terms of what the state of Israel will do in the next 50 years. The state of Israel will not live up to the great hopes and challenges, I mean, of Judaic ethics. I'm not speaking now about economics and science. I mean, this is a secondary problem to me. Then the whole Jewish history will appear in a different light. People will reinterpret Jewish history. So the Jews were nice, decent, because people didn't have the opportunity to be wicked. But as soon as they got opportunity, I mean, they proved to the world they're not better than anybody else.
Are you talking about being wicked as a state, as a government, or as individuals?
I see both. It's reflected.
But why didn't Jews have an opportunity to be wicked in the past?
Okay, wickedness always is an expression, is interdependent with simply with power. If a man has no power, he cannot be wicked.
But he didn't have power in the state, but in his individual life and in his group he had that power.
Yes, but don't forget that the Jews, even as a group, had power, but the group itself was persecuted. You understand? The powerful group within the Jewish community was persecuted by the outside community. So the person who was about to persecute the weaker one, he himself knew what persecution meant. There wasn't a single Jew, the most powerful Jew, who did not taste and experience persecution. And the experience of persecution itself is already a mitigating circumstance. And if I experience something unpleasant on the part of someone who is more powerful than I cannot simply pass on this experience to a person who is subordinated to me. Sometimes psychologically you say the one who is weak out in his office so becomes a tyrant at home, but this is basically an exception. That's why the Jews were a persecuted race simply felt, had compassion for the weak. But if the Jews should become not a persecuted race, but an equal to others, how will they act? I don't know.
I hope you act differently. I hope that such laws as such committees as are un-American, they are committed on American activities, and such a distorted law as the law pertaining, the one pertaining immigration, cannot be passed by the Knesset in Israel. But to tell you, I'm going to take a note now. For that, I would be a bit over optimistic. Some voices I hear sometimes in the debates in the Knesset, which I dislike. I mean, it's just I'm thinking out aloud. It's not a part of my lecture. And to me, this is the most important problem. The Jew of the diaspora should be proud of Israel, regardless of what, if one is a Zionist or he does not affiliate himself with the political movement. But still, Israel is Jewish, I mean. If we don't consider Israel Jewish, at least the outside community considers Israel Jewish, I mean. It's certainly a Jewish institution. But never mind. Never mind what our feelings toward Israel are. And the question is not whether Israel will defeat the Arabs on the field of battle. I'm very proud of that. But this is not, I mean, after all, a victorious army is not exclusively a Jewish, so to say, institution, I mean. Whether we'll defeat our evil within our own community, we'll be victorious in this field. To me, this is the most important problem with God is on. To say what will happen, one has got to be a prophet, I don't know. Okay. Of course,
so Rachel, do you think that it's possible in a state which may turn socialistic, secularistic, to be still socialistic, secularistic, and live up to the Judaic principle?
I'll tell you, I believe that one of my topics, whether I'll reach this topic today or not, is the problem of the non-religious Jew. When I come to this topic, I'll discuss the problem. I mean, did you mention it?
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't know whether I'll get to it. I mean, I cannot make...
You said something else before, which I'm concerned about. You said something about the modern man cannot, is not interested in the individual, and that the small individual doesn't count as much as the large individual. That's not a concept of modern man today, that we don't have this sort of thing. That's only an old Judaic concept. I thought you said it. Did you say
yes, something? I say only modern man, his quest for democracy, has not simply, I mean, introduced equality as to the worth of individuals.
Except for this, we as social workers like to talk of ourselves about being interested in the dignity of every individual and every human being.
Yes, correct. But I'll tell you, I mean, as social workers, you deal with small people, basically. Because big people don't need help.
But they give us the money to give help.
Yeah, oh yeah. I would like to ask you, I mean, and please excuse my arrogance, perhaps I become a bit impudent, about your inner feelings when someone comes to you and you're a consultant, one who needs help, a poor man. Okay. Yeah. So you have the same approach to him as you have have when you talk, for instance, to the governor of the state, to Nelson Rockefeller. I mean, just I would ask you to do a bit of soul searching. I mean, the same approach, do you feel emotionally, I mean, that you treat this one just like you were?
It should be a very poor professor who was teaching me something.
Yes.
I'd have the same reaction.
A poor professor whom you consider a scholar? Yeah, because then he's a big person in your eyes. Because he had contributed
and
to society.
And the poor little Muhammad who comes in, who he's no great man of the community.
Yes.
He's just an ordinary, fine little man, but he has something, that's all. Because we see in every individual something.
You should see it. You should see at least, yes. I mean, it's more a norm than a fact, I would say. It's an ideal. I mean, I'm speaking as a rabbi. I certainly supposed to see in everybody, I mean, so the reflection of our father Abraham, I mean, of course, yes, I should, but I don't. With regard to me, there is quite a gap, a gulf between practice and ideal, I mean, and I believe the same gulf, I mean, could be found in the field of social work. I mean, isn't that possible? I know that when I speak, for instance, when I speak to a person who is powerful, not that I'm afraid of him, I'm not afraid of him, I don't need his favor. But when I speak to a person who is prominent, as a scientist, as a political figure, or even a man who is prominent in the field of economic accomplishment, it's rich. Not that I need anything. I always discover myself, to my own surprise, a sense of reverence. Well, when I take a taxi and I give a tip to the cabman, there's no reverent attitude on my part. I mean, that is what I discover in about myself. I mean, I believe that this experience, it can be universalized and generalized and applied to everybody. I mean, because I'm not worse than anybody, nor am I better. And they say, and Judaism was pressing this point vigorously, passionately. Now, of course, and this again, as I said last time, because men, we have, there are two personalities. There's the charismatic personality, as I say, charismatic Adam. The existential experience. And who knows who has a deeper existential experience? And who has a warmer heart? And who has a more tender soul? The great philosopher Kant, or a pauper or a beggar? It's very hard to say. It's the famous statement in Talmud, "Mai chazid edamach sumek tveid yomodamach dechavres mutei." How do you know that your blood is red? Perhaps the blood of your fellow man, your neighbor, is redder, is more red. It's not a question of redness of the blood. Who knows who is greater, you and or I? Measured by contributions, there are objective criteria by which we can judge the greatness of a person. Measured by the inner experience, there are no criteria. Only God can measure, not human beings. This is exactly what it is.
Rabbi, you used the word a great deal, existentialist experience.
I didn't say existentialist experience, because existential experience means the experience of the existentialist. I'm not an existentialist, so I cannot know. I said existential experience.
All right, can you help me with the...
It is the experience that we call the ego consciousness, the ego awareness, that I am the experience of the I. Of the I. But when we say existentialist experience means the experience of the existentialist philosopher, it's already a doctrine. I say existential experience, the experience of my own existence, you understand? That I am. Who am I? As I said last lecture, because no one can answer the question, who I am. I can answer the question, who I am in terms of contributions. If it's a question of mass and energy equation, I cannot answer the question, who I am in terms of intrinsic worth. I always can answer who I am with regard to others. I cannot answer who I am with regard to myself. There is, again, I must refer to Peretz. I think a lot of him, although he was ideologically, was a secular Jew, I'm a religious Jew. There is a novel, a short story by him. It's called The Meshuggah Bottle, and I don't know how to translate.
Ne'er do well.
Huh?
Ne'er do well.
Never do well. Never do well, no. This is the technical, it's a bit clumsy, I would say. A bottle means a man, bottle means to idle, not to contribute. The man who didn't contribute anything, Yeshiv bottle means a man didn't do anything. It's playboys, but not in the sense of playboys, A loafer has a certain derogatory, so to say, meaning, but it's not derogatory. A man who is not fitted into the world to serve society. I mean, misfit.
The German Taugenicht.
Yes, Taugenicht is, and it's not battle, and it's a bit resembles, there's a little resemblance.
That's an example of our inability to communicate feelings.
Yes, we are about all that one. So, and the whole question with the Meshuggah Bottle, and Peretz says, who am I? Who am I? It means that it begins, of course, in his primitive manner. Here in this little town, in this little village, people know me. Why they know me? They know my address, they know my name, they know my jacket, they know my suit, they know my hat, so they recognize me. But who am I? Am I the suit I wear? Am I the house I'm residing in? It means, can I be explained to others in terms of the externals of contributions? Or my existence expresses itself in more intrinsic terms, in inwardness. So what does my inwardness stand for? And this is a question which is many times disturbing me as well. I don't consider myself a battle, but it's a question. Am I only that what I appear to others to be? I'm more than that. Now, Judaism, in formulating its social ethic, and I tell you again, gentlemen, I have to beg your pardon. Whatever I say is, to me, it's truism. It's simply, it is commonplace. But somehow, and I don't believe that there is anything new, but I have to speak about it, because something most elementary and most axiomatic things are many times unknown, or not so much unknown, they haven't been spelled out. That's all. But they're axiomatic in Judaism. Judaism, in formulating its social ethic, was particularly concerned with human dignity and the awareness of self-worthiness. Self-worthiness. One of the most basic rights of the individual, we have many rights, basic rights, of course, American Declaration of Independence and Constitution is based on natural rights, so-called lex naturae, about the 17th century spoke so much, the Stoa, the Roman Stoics. But there is a certain right which, I don't know, Judaism has formulated, and I haven't found such a formula in any other system of ethics. One of the most basic rights of the individual is the right to know and to experience personal dignity and worth in living. The right to dignity. We have the right to work, not in the sense of which the legislation are being, bills are being introduced in the various legislatures, but the right to work, the right to defense, to self-defense, the right to live, but the right to dignity. What does it mean? Anyone who interferes with the intrinsic prerogative of men and injures one's self-respect, they inflict injury not on the body. The body injury, everybody understands. I must not. But I inflict injury upon the self-respect of a person who will be severely punished by God. To insult one's neighbor or to hurt his pride. And don't, and don't please interpret it in terms of libel and slander. Not slander, not libel. Slander or libel is something else. Slander or libel means if I indict him, I accuse him of something he didn't do. All right. It's not spreading malicious rumors. Just an unintentional injury. I mean, upon his, inflicted upon his pride. An insult. To hurt his pride or embarrass him, even causing embarrassment, particularly if this embarrassment is caused to him in public, in the presence of others, is equated by our moral code as murder. Yes, I mean, I'm not exaggerating. Correct, yes. And let us not forget, and I'll tell you why it was classified as murder. Let us not forget that the Hebrew term for murder is shvichut damim, bloodshed. Bloodshed. And under this heading, under semantically, when you say bloodshedding or bloodshed, any painful experience, the Halacha understood it, any painful experience which causes a flush of anger, shame, or sudden paling of a frightened face is an act of bloodshed. Because what is mean Malbin? Malbin Hebrew means one pales. Why pale? I felt embarrassed. I felt frightened. I felt injured. I felt hurt. There's a change in the blood circulation, the temper blood circulation. You see, paling and is a flash of anger, shame, or sudden paling of a frightened face is an act of murder. And the famous expression, Kol amalbim pnei chaverei barabim, whoever shames his, not only shame, hurts the pride of his friend, of his neighbor, in public, he is treated or penalized as if he had committed murder and had killed him. And the Talmud continues and said, Noach leilo Adam sheyapil atzmo lekif shanayesh val yalvim pnei chaverei barabim. One should incur rather martyrdom than embarrass his comrade in public. Amalbim pnei chaverei barabim ein lechelek leilam habo. Whoever shames his neighbor in the presence of others will not share in the world to come. Bliss in the world to come, beatitude in the future world, are denied to one who shamed his friend. It's interesting. It was not denied to the murderer, but it was denied to the one who shamed his friend. Because shaming a friend in public is many times more subtle and more cruel than to kill a person. This was the opinion. So the right to dignity is many times was placed above the right to live. Although, gentlemen, the right to self-respect was bestowed by the Creator upon everyone, without, upon the king and upon the pauper, special emphasis was placed upon the dignity of the humble. Of course, the king is also. I mean, to shame the president of the United States is not a very ethical deed. And believe me, many times when I read the press, I listen to pre-election campaign speeches. Of course, they speak about the most powerful person in the United States. But many times, I think, I try to take, for instance, a speech, a Texas speech, the Times always accommodates me, and just red pencil certain lines and try to classify them under Jewish ethical categories. What our Talmudic scholars would have thought if they had read a speech delivered about anybody? Shaming, insulting, hurting, abusing. For good purpose, perhaps. But this is not... I think how is within the framework of Jewish ethics, a political campaign is complete impossibility. Impossibility. Because when even our people in Israel, when they get engaged, become engaged in the political campaign, and they are not sure there either of invectives and compliments and about opponents. So they are not Jews anymore. They are not Jews. It's not Jewish. I'm sorry, but political campaign is not a Jewish institution. It's not always not a Jewish institution. It's completely abhorrent to the religious conscience. Unless you... It's not only you must not say falsehoods. You must not hurt anybody if you tell the truth. This business of exposing a person. It's a good piece of journalism, of course. People get the Pulitzer Prize for that. But from a Judaic viewpoint, it is something which is obnoxious, repulsive. It's a crime. This is the real Amal bin Pnei Chaveri Barabim, shaming one in the public. Either a larger public than the one which read the press, and even with regard to truthfulness. It's a good question. Of course, such type of idealism may many times be exploited in order to tolerate evil. Correct, you are right. But there are limits. For instance, if the person, what do you call, becomes a roide, if it means he's a menace to public safety, then you expose him, but also when you expose the wicked, there are many ways of exposing them. You don't dramatize it. You don't play it up. I mean, you know, you don't try to appeal to the lower instinct of the crowd. I mean, you know how journalism, particularly the yellow type, I mean, does such things. But there's got to be a menace to public safety. What is called roidish in Hebrew. I mean, a menace without being a menace to public safety. I'll give you an example. For instance, you know what it means in Jewish life, meant a moser. You know what a moser is? One who squeals. Squealer. Squeals, informer. Of course, I mean, in Middle Ages, I mean, the informer was the most despicable individual. I mean, he was a public menace, no doubt about it. Yes, it's interesting. So Moser always, the Jews interpreted Moser in terms of passing on information to the enemy. It's correct. This is basically espionage, the enemy. And since the Jews in the Middle Ages were surrounded by enemies, so any information passed down to the authorities was classified as betrayal, as espionage and misservative. But basically, Jewish ethicists say that even if there is a Jewish state, if there were a Jewish state, and one knows of something, of a crime which his neighbor committed, a crime in which public safety is not involved, I want you to know, but it's a crime. He has no right to inform the Jewish authorities either. You are not a judge.
In other words, how about a witness in a trial?
You are right.
In a civil matter.
Unless he's summoned.
He has no right to offer to appeal.
Not in civil matters. Civil matters, in money matters, yes. In money matters, first of all, he has no right. He is not obligated unless he's summoned by the party which is interested. But money matters, many times, simply is not informing. It's a question only of pertaining to a deal, I mean, where the person himself is not involved in that. The question in criminal matters. In criminal matters, is basically most scholars say, unless the best din, the court, forces him to testify. He must not volunteer information. Unless this type of crime is endangered simply, the lives of other individuals. Then it's a different story. In general, Judaism has grappled with the problem of judging people. Even the problem of a court was a mystery to Jews. How can a Jew judge his fellow man? Is he perfect that he can pass on judgment upon others? And that's why the position of the Dayan, of the so-called justice judge, is a very precarious one in Jewish ethics. The Talmud says a judge should see himself as if hell, the purgatory, is underneath, and divine wrath up from above. It's a very unpleasant position, you see, to be between the devil and the blue sea, you see. And many times when I've never been in court, but when I read about the reasoning which accompany any sentence, then I feel that the judge considers himself, he's so complacent about himself, and he considers himself perfect and entitled to pass on judgment on others, I always think about the Jewish approach, dear George. And that's why the Talmudic scholars recommended that no one should accept a judgeship, an appointment as a judge. Because it's something inhuman in that. Only one has a right to judge people, and this is God, no one else. And basically, judging people is an evil with which the halacha, which was realistic, had to come to terms. You see, many things in Judaism is not that were not liked. And Judaism accepted them reluctantly. But what could you do? I mean, after all, I mean, we need a society, we need some assemblies of order, we need a state. Otherwise, it will be war of all against all, I mean, in the expression of Hobbes, you see.
I understand it was quite a struggle within Jewish circles around the Rosenberg trial and Judge Kaufman and his...
Yes,
I understand many of the... I understand a few of the rabbis tried to get to him to discuss with him the Jewish ethics of Jewish point of view.
It was very wrong at his part. Extremely wrong. Basically, I believe that in the case of the Rosenberg trial, I don't believe that a man was so stupid as to give a death sentence for espionage in peacetime, God, I believe, wasn't it? Because, I mean, we simply were small people. It was the amount of damage they did to the safety of the United States could not be determined. And when this famous atomic scientist in England, Fuchs, I mean, betrayed, so certainly, I mean, if Russia had taken advantage of our research, indeed, I mean, information came to them through Fuchs, but not through small, ignorant people. I mean, this was terrible. In my opinion, it was murder. Bloodshed and murder. Awesome.
Aren't you, in a sense, judging yourself now?
Yes, you're right. I shouldn't say that. You're right. Mea maxima culpa, my sins, of course. Yes, you're right. You're certainly right. You're right. I'm not denying them. You're right. But sometimes you can't suppress.
The judge was there to do it. The only difference.
What can you do? Okay. I mean, he did not do a service to the United States, certainly. He did not enhance the prestige of the United States, nor did he enhance, so to say, the security of the United States. The United States is secure enough. There's no need for it. Of course, it was the McCarthy atmosphere, I mean, this hysterical, I mean, climate, and fear, simply. He was afraid. And what bothers my mind is that, what he said, when I can't fall asleep at night, I think, what if this judge were not a Jew, but a Christian, would he have? I mean, end up a death sentence. And I'm inclined to say no.
Suppose his wife's name wasn't Rosenberg.
Huh? Beg your pardon? Again, I suppose, the other, from the other end. And suppose, I mean, the two little people were not Jews. It was the unfortunate coincidence of a Jew versus a Jew. And that's what disturbs me more than anything else.
Is that from a Jewish point of view that you're objecting to this thing, or from some other point of view? Is it part of halakha, for instance, that this thing, that man, no man should have judged at all?
No.
Or that he made the wrong, that this was the wrong judgment?
The severity of the judge, of this sentence. I'm not criticizing the sentence itself. And this is a Jewish viewpoint. Well, I don't say you should take your spies and tell them just compliment them. Or give them a reward. I mean, they should be locked up for a while, no doubt about that. But, I mean, in general, death penalty, now according to the lucky concept, is an impossibility almost.
The question I brought in, the fact is that he indicated, Judge Kaufman indicated, that he looked at his God.
Well, this is exactly what I don't like.
Judgment.
This is exactly about this case.
And that's why I believe Rabbi Rachman and perhaps others went to see him in terms of trying to interpret his God, if you will,
right.
He was appealing to a greater...
This is exactly what I disliked about it, the story that he walked into the temple and consulted his God. But it's a funny God he consulted. It's a McCarthy God, not a Jewish God. I don't know whether the man was sincere or not. I'll tell you things I don't know him. I have no right to judge, as you said. Well, since you pressed me for an answer.
Well,
Yes.
Except for we do have a right to question whether, in terms of the statement that we're folding around the table that the judge had made, whether this was and is in line with.
Yes.
And in what way can you rationalize, if you will, that this is possible?
Not possible. Rationalize
the position
what?
That he took.
No, to me, it's not rational.
Obviously, many of us around the table say that it is not possible, but he
took. To introduce Judaism, the God of Israel, into this institution of the death penalty, for small people who apparently did not do much damage to the safety of the United States, this was not unwarranted. The less relevant to one's kerygma is, that means his message to society, his contribution, the more concerned society must be with his inner pride and dignity. This is the Judaic concept. Do you have a Bible, in English? Yes. If you'll take Leviticus 19:14, gentlemen. 19:14. You have it? Excuse me, gentlemen. Yes. Yes, 19:14. Thou shalt not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but shalt fear thy God. I am the Lord. You shalt not curse the deaf, and you should not put a stumbling block before the blind. You shall fear thy God. I am the Lord. It means I don't tolerate it. The deaf and blind, why only the deaf? Am I allowed, permitted to curse anybody who still can hear the curse uttered? Certainly not. But with the deaf one, against whom nature has discriminated, the cripple, Judaism has a unique approach with regard to that one. The deaf and the blind are representative of a class of people handicapped physically and socially anonymous. Because a deaf person can't accomplish much, unless he's an Edison or a Beethoven. And lonely. The Torah singles them out. Be careful not to vex or cause any harm to them. First. Then, for instance, if we'll take another sentence, just, I'll tell you just where it is. Just a minute. Yes, it is Exodus 23:20, chapter 23, verse 20. Thou shalt neither vex a stranger, nor oppress him, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. Ye shall not afflict any widow or fatherless child. If thou afflict them in any wise, and they cry at all unto me, I will surely hear their cry. And my wrath shall wax hot, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall be widows, and your children fatherless. Very severe words. Yes, sir.
The anti-Maimonidean controversy, the Karaite Rabbanan controversy, the Hasidic Elijah Goen versus Misnag.
Yeah.
Would that be included within the Malbin Nechavero or not?
You mean certain acts on the part of the rabbinate against dissidents, yes?
Over through the centuries we've had.
Against dissidents. Against dissidents.
Yes.
Perhaps yes. I'll be very frank with you. Perhaps yes. Perhaps it was wrong. Regardless of the fact that such a great authority as the Gaon of Vilna did it. Regardless of that. I don't believe it was in conformity with Jewish ethics.
My question is, a statement like that
is
a wish, an ideal, a flash, which has not become rooted as such in Jewish life, or whether it was a guiding principle.
You are right. Whether it's just an ideal, Christianity has many ideals which have never been put into effect. That's a good question. I believe, and I am very objective about it, I try to treat it in a detached manner. It's no use, romanticizing our past, or trying to weave, our fantasy should weave a halo around our heroes. I believe with certain exceptions, more or less, it was reality. Yeah. With certain exceptions. Of course, human beings, however great, cannot, many times, cannot control themselves. But with certain exceptions, yes, I would say. Thou shalt neither, yes, all right. Yes. Why widow and orphan? They shouldn't oppress anybody. Why only the widow and orphan? Why only not to wax the stranger? And the resident citizen, you're allowed to wax? You're allowed to annoy? You're allowed to embarrass? No. I mean, the law, my mind says the law applies to everybody. But why did the Torah single out the stranger, the orphan, and the widow? The answer they said before. The widow, the orphan, the stranger are typical of a class of people who are defenseless, weak, and occupy a very anonymous station in society. It is the symbol of anonymity. And there is specific emphasis placed upon hurting the anonymous individual. Because if you hurt the President of the United States, he can recover from the shock. But if you hurt an anonymous individual, the shock can be so powerful that he'll never recover from it. I mean mentally, I mean emotionally. Maimonides writes, if you want to know the source, it is Deyot. Deyot means virtues, the book which deals with virtues, 6:9. A man ought to be especially heedful of his behavior toward the widows and orphans, for their souls are exceedingly depressed and their spirits low. One must not speak to them, address himself to them, otherwise than tenderly. One must show them unwavering courtesy, not hurt them physically, with hard toil, nor wound their feelings or hurt with harsh words. Whoever irritates them, provokes them to anger, pains them, tyrannizes them, or even shames them, or hurts their pride, is guilty of a transgression. And still more so if one beats them or curses them. Again, the station of the non-prominent citizen. Remarkable is a story revealed in the Michilta. It's a midrash. It's a strange story. Strange story, it's very typical. You know the history of the 10 martyrs, I mean the famous Asara Rugi Malchut, I mean the 10 martyrs during the Roman occupation of Palestine. Among them were the greatest Jewish scholars like Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Ishmael. I mean, actually the fathers of the Talmud, of Talmudic halakhic Judaism. Martyrs, because, I mean, there was a wave of religious persecution and they did not conform to the Roman edict prohibiting enjoining Jews from practicing their religion. So the story, and it looks to be quite historical. The story is mentioned twice, once in the Michilta and another Talmudic book. When Rabbi Gamliel was the Duke of the Jews, it was simply occupied the place of the king, the prince. He was called Rabbi Gamliel the prince. And Rabbi Ishmael, the high priest, he was the high priest, who were sentenced to death and taken to the place of execution. Rabbi Gamliel the prince began suddenly to sob, to cry. Rabbi Ishmael, it's almost a literal translation, addressed himself to his colleague and said, I mean, it's literal, Prince in Israel, Nisi Israel, I mean, that's in Hebrew. Prince in Israel, why do you cry? Just a few steps separate us, or thou, thee, from our Father in heaven. And he said it, I mean, in Hebrew it's still nicer. In a few short moments, you'll be sitting in the lap of the Shekhinah. You know what Shekhinah means. This is divinity as a mother. Divinity symbolized as a mother, not as a father. Rabbi Gamliel answered, I'm not frightened by the prospect of death. I'm not afraid of the tortures. I cry because we are going to be executed like ordinary criminals, while we did not commit any offense for which we would have to suffer the death penalty. Simply, he doesn't understand why he's killed. We ask the question, why? A martyr, a saint, about to incur, I mean, to sacrifice himself on the altar for the perpetuation of Jewish tradition and Jewish people, and they are the ones who saved the Jews, the Jewish people from disintegration. That's right. They actually, by their example, by their fortitude and boldness, yes. So, I mean, ask a question. It's a question, what we call a question which belongs in theodicy, the problem of evil. Why? Why did God do that? So Rabbi Ishmael answered, and the answer is very typical and said, my prince and master of the world, Nisi Yisrael Rabbi Umeiri, my prince and master and teacher, permit me to say something to you. So Rabbi Gamliel said, all right, go on. Perhaps once you were taking an afternoon nap, and while you were dozing off, a poor woman with a loaf of bread came into your house to inquire of you whether or not the bread was clean or unclean. It means now we say we come with the problem of meat, whether the meat is kosher or not kosher. In that period, they observed the laws of cleanliness with regard to bread. So whatever, when a poor woman calls the rabbi, I mean, comes into the rabbi with a chicken to take a look, whether the chicken is kosher or not, at that time, they didn't speak about chickens, about fowl, they spoke about kikot. I mean, loaves of bread. Well, the bread is clean or unclean. It means fit according to the law for consumption or not. It means simply I came with a problem, whether or not it was clean or unclean. And your servant or butler told her to wait a while until you will come out of your bedroom. I mean, he went into the bedroom and wakened Rabbi Gamliel from his sleep, the prince. But of course, he can't jump out of bed and go out into the waiting room. He had to get dressed. So it took him a few moments to get dressed. And while you were dressing, the lonely widow sighed and felt hurt. She thought that if the person who came to the prince were more prominent, Rabbi Gamliel would have come out, had been more prominent, he would have come out right away. All she had to wait is 5 seconds until he got dressed. And you know, I mean, dressing in olden time didn't take as much as it takes us now. You see, you, my prince and master, know that the penalty for such a transgression, it means to oppress a widow, is Varakti Eschem Bechorem, and I'll slay the sword, you just read it. That's all. This paradoxical story is very unique. Not only was every woman whose mind was bothered by a problem allowed to approach the prince in Israel, apparently there was no telephone, no appointment, either way. I mean, if Rabbi Gamliel had received visitors by appointment only, the whole problem couldn't have developed. You see, I mean, So she opened the door and walked in. And Rabbi Gamliel, not an ordinary rabbi, this was the king of Israel, the prince. You see, upper the prince and master of the Jewish community, and none was barred from the gates of the palace, whether he lived in the palace or not, I don't know, or in a humble hut. But the prince was duty-bound to receive her at once, not to let her wait, lest she might feel hurt. Moreover, the Torah expects the prince to leave strict instructions with his valet that he must wake him up in a case of inquiry is made by some unknown person, and he must step out right away, I mean immediately, of his bedroom in order, I mean, to attend to business. And the penalty for it is death. Of course, it is almost impractical. It is an ideal, but you see about the Talmud was a bit Freudian about dreams. He said, the Talmud also said, dreams reflect the personality. Ideals also reflect the religious conscience.
It means we shouldn't have any waiting lists in our region.
Sure, I mean that. I mean, but I, instead of addressing myself to you, I should address myself to myself. I shouldn't let people wait. I'm just a sinner as all of us.
But somehow I think evil can come from a can come as a result of a very puritanical kind of attitude towards just towards living in.
Yeah, you mean if men should become completely not critical, so to say, and accept everybody? Yes, of course. But as I said to you before, Judaism has also, you see, Judaism operates with two valid, so it means with two, with the thesis and antithesis, I mean. I'll come with regard to the community, what Judaism requires, I mean, because it simply sometimes immobilizes and paralyzes action, I mean, this tender approach. But it is in Judaism. I'm just reporting, nothing else. And I say reporting about elementary things, I mean, there's nothing which I... This manifestation of peculiar considerateness, perseverance, and tenderness toward the lowly and meek ones on the part of Judaic ethics can only be understood if seeing the light of the imitatio Dei idea that man should imitate God. I emphasized in my previous lecture, or perhaps two lectures before, that man can reach God only as a forlorn, helpless, lonely being, not as a powerful being. If man comes into the temple or into the synagogue as a judge, as Kaufman did, so he has no contact with God. A judge is an authority. His will's power, there is no contact with God. Men endowed with power cannot approach God. Who can approach God? The man who is stripped of everything, forgotten by everyone. Men forsaken and forgotten by everyone. No company, no friendship, save God. Only God has forgotten. The prophets emphasized time and again that God, the master of creation, of the great cosmic drama, of the innumerable galaxies and the uncharted planes of the universe, humbles himself to commune with the individual and abide in the tents of the poor and the oppressed. Sustenance of reality as a whole, in total, on the one hand, and support of the lonely person on the other hand, are two pursuits in which God engages with equal concern and love. And, for instance, we'll take Isaiah. Where is it? Yes, it's Isaiah, the last chapter. It is 46. No, it's 66. 66, verse 1 and 2, correct? Thus says the Lord, the heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. It means complete mastery over the universe. Where is the house that ye build unto me? And where is the place of my rest? It means God is infinite. For all those things hath my hand made, and all those things have been, says the Lord, but to this man will I look, even to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit, and trembles at my word. Both, on the one hand, infinity, what we call in Hebrew is pashtus, God is infinite, and God can become so small, so we say it infinitesimal, that he can come in the low tent of the poor person. Kabbalah call it, it's Ein Sof, means infinity, and Tzimtzum, contraction on the part of God. He fits in into the smallest tent. He doesn't fit in into the cosmos, he fits also in into the smallest room. God exalted over all creation, far and transcendent, is concerned with the poor and contrite spirit. He seeks the company of the lowly and addresses himself to him. Now I ask you, I mean, you did you this of the Yidlachot?
Yeah, we gave that out.
Now, at the end, interesting is,
at the exit of the Shabbos, of the Sabbath. It's very interesting.
Send it out at least on Tuesday.
Yes, at the conclusion of the Sabbath. It's very interesting. When a Jew actually, recites, recites the prayer, the first prayer of the weekday, of Chol. So at the end of this prayer, so the Jew quotes a passage from the Talmud. Rabbi Yochanan said, wherever you find the Lord's greatness mentioned, you find his gentleness indicated. This is so in the Torah, again in the prophets, and the third time in the Psalms. It is written in the Torah, the Lord your God is the supreme God, the supreme Lord, the great God, mighty and revered, who is never partial and never takes a bribe. And immediately afterward it says, he secures justice for the orphan and the widow, and loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Great! But the great God humbles himself to be the companion of the stranger. Can the President of the United States invite himself some foreigner if he's not a diplomat? I mean, even about Roosevelt, I read, I don't know whether it was true or not, Farley wrote it, but I take it as true that Mrs. Roosevelt said once to him, my husband cannot relax in company of such people who are culturally not equal, his equal. I mean, it's a very natural statement. There's nothing derogatory about it. I cannot relax either. I mean, a company, of people who are culturally below me. And I imagine someone is superior to me cannot relax in my company. So there is not democracy. But God, the greatest of all, can relax, if I may use this word, perhaps blasphemous, but I may use the word, relax in the company of the ignorant, poor, and lowly. Again, it is written the prophets. Thus says the High and Lofty One, who inhabits eternity, whose name is Holy. I dwell in the high and holy place, and sing to God, sing praises to his name, extol him, who is in heaven. Lord is his name, and exalt before him. And immediately afterward it says, a father of orphans, a champion of widows, is God in his holy habitation. This combination. A man should not only be high, he should be Lord. He should be not all of his culture, sometimes uncultured, be able to speak with the most primitive press. This is an ability, gentlemen. As a rabbi, I know, I couldn't. Sometimes with primitive press, particularly in religion, person comes with such primitive ideas. Primitive ideas, superstition. Of course, sometimes the boundary line between religious lofty ideals and superstition is simply so blurred that people don't know. And it come to me many times, with such foolish questions, and many times I display impatience. A woman comes to me, her husband died, and she is afraid that the spirit of her husband still abides in her home, because at night she puts away the dishes, and then she finds the dishes in a different place. Of course, it's a question of arteriosclerosis. She simply forgets. She's an elderly woman, she forgets. She herself puts away the dishes. There can be different attitudes on the part of the rabbi how to treat this word. You see, it's a question of patience. And patience is always, of course, you can train yourself to be patient, I believe. Social workers don't need any instruction in that. But it's also a question of axiological appraisal, how you appraise that word. If you look upon her as your equal, because she has intrinsic worth, you and I will be patient. But if you look down upon her and him, then patience is a very difficult virtue. You have to constrain yourself to be patient. And the idea is not to constrain oneself to be patient. The idea refers to inner esteem, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, to inner esteem, to appreciate the lower spirit as perhaps as noble as my, so to say, sophisticated. This is exactly what Judaism is. Not only perseverance can be a mechanical, just quality, synthetic. Judaism didn't believe in, on the contrary, Judaism did not believe that one should cover up.